All right. Good morning. As I was, going through and learning, once we hit the Yosef, all the narratives of Yosef, especially in Mitzrayim, I noticed in my Tanakh, like, I underline words and circle words and write little notes on the side, but all of a sudden I started noticing little tally marks just on the very side of the margin. And at first, it's like, what in the world is that? Obviously, I wrote it there. I have no idea what I was writing, though. And then I remembered that this must have been, I guess, 2 years ago. It had bothered me. Why does it switch back and forth between Paro and Melech Mitzrayim? Paro is kind of the dominant term that's used, most common, but it does... The Pesukim, at the very beginning of Perek Mem, for example, it says, "Vayhi achar dvar ma'eli chatu mashke melech Mitzrayim, va'ofe lad nehem lemelech Mitzrayim." And then in Pasuk Beis, "V'yiktov paro al shnei sarasav." So, why? What's the point of switching? Why switch? And I realized I had gone through and kind of tallied up how many times each term is used. And obviously, again, paro is the most common, if not for a large part of the rest of Sefer Bereishis, the only one used. I did the same thing for Sefer Shmos. I didn't put that on here, though. So then I was just looking around to try and figure out what do people say about paro versus Melech Mitzrayim and just kind of see if there's any other patterns that match up. And what those might mean. So, the first place we see a paro, it's not our paro from Yosef's story, but a paro nonetheless, is in with Abraham going down to Mitzrayim. And there, that's when Abraham realizes that his wife Sarah is very beautiful and is afraid that the Egyptians are going to take her. And in Pasuk Tesvav, in the first source, Viru osa sari faro, Vialu osa el paro, Vitukach ha'isha beis paro. Again, just paro, paro, paro. And throughout the narrative there, it's all paro. There's no mention of Melech or Melech Mitzrayim. And historically, paro is not a person's name. It's the title. It just means, in ancient Egyptian, apparently means the great house. So it's connotates kind of the house of the monarch, of the king, and then it becomes, at least the way that we utilize it, is paro so and so, paro Ramses, for example. So here, there's no name given, and it's just kind of the vague monarch that Abraham was dealing with. And Ibn Ezra, he's talking in Shmos, but in Source 2, it says, "Call Yoshev al Kisei Malchus Mitzrayim, Yikra Balashon Mitzrayim, Paro." So, again, Paro just, at least in the way that it was being used, just means the king of Egypt. Melech Mitzrayim. Hine akasuv lohi gid shemo. So here, he's speaking about, obviously, when you have Vayakam Melech Chadash, and just the paro in the story of Yitzias Mitzrayim, there's no name given, whereas there are other places in Tanakh where the name is given. Kefaro Necho in Yirmiyahu, Kach Hashmo Bala Shan Amo. His name was Necho, and that's what he was called in Egyptian. And so too, a little bit earlier in Yirmiyahu, Paro Chafra. And it's interesting there, Ibn Ezra doesn't note this, but when you look at those actual psukim, it says Paro Necho Melech Mitzrayim, Paro Chafra Melech Mitzrayim. So there it uses kind of the full term, and it's almost, it would seem like a redundancy to say Paro if that, as per the Ibn Ezra, means Melech Mitzrayim, and then immediately after that, say Melech Mitzrayim after his name.
It's does that ever say that it mean what it means? I think he just says that anyone who's called who's rules in Egypt is called power. He doesn't necessarily define it as meaning the king of Egypt.
Right, but if you're Yoshev al Kisei Malchus Mitzrayim, doesn't that mean you're the Melech Mitzrayim? It's true. What you're saying is true. He doesn't actually say Melech Mitzrayim.
Because you could say calling him Par Melech Mitzrayim is redundant if it literally means that he's the king of Egypt. But Par is, I guess, the name they use to refer to him. So it could be that someone from outside of Egypt, if you referred to him as Par, wouldn't necessarily know that that meant you were referring to your king.
Right. So that's fair. I think that's a fair point.
So I'm just picking up on a nuance.
Yeah. So I wrote some notes. I said when in Rome. So when you're in Egypt, he's called Paro because that's what people in that locale call him. But right, maybe somewhere else.
Sycamore necessarily written to the local Egyptians, and call yourself reading it. Yes, at the time, I guess just came out of Egypt, they would know that reality. But today, we wouldn't necessarily be expected to know that. So you would need that, you know.
Right, if we're thinking in a vacuum without the fact that we understand who Paro is. Yeah, yeah. No, so that.
Meaning like,
I guess. Right, and it also, if you look at the next source in later on in Bracious, where
right,
and fundamentally they're synonymous.
Right.
It's just, is there some sort of, are you getting a cultural nuance, or are you kind of being placed in that environment by using Paro? Right, so there you maybe would gain something, but and it doesn't. If we're just saying that Paro is, that's just how you say anybody who sits al kisei malchus Mitzrayim in the Egyptian language, then why, when we talk about all these other kings, for example, in source 3, we have this whole slew of kings, you know. Rafael, Melech Shinar, Arioch, Melech Elasar, etc., etc., where it gives the name of the king, the word king, and then where they're from. So, Amraphel, Melech Shinar. And that's the pattern it follows through the rest of the narrative there. Why don't we use whatever language they were speaking, their word for king before their name, before their name, like it did with Paro.
But maybe only in Egypt was the king actually, from generation to generation, we refer to the king as Paro, whereas in these other countries, you're the king of the country, and they didn't necessarily have like a specific name that you switched to when you became king.
Well, oh, you mean like the name that you're called by?
Yes.
Like
like
in England, you get an official name. I mean, it happens to be Queen Elizabeth right now, didn't change her name, but they theoretically change your name. That kind of thing, versus the title Queen.
Right.
That could be, but Paro. So they don't even have. They have to have some sort of title for him, I would think.
But
beyond his name.
But King could be that. Melech could be that.
Oh, okay, so that but that's
whatever
my point.
Whatever Melech in their language.
But that's my point, though. Why didn't the Torah translate it into their, leave it in their language like it did with Paro? Here it just translated into the Hebrew.
I guess because there's going through so many of them, and it was trying to give you a uniform picture of who they were, to then use the word in each of their languages would
right.
also create a uniform puzzle.
Right, it's already kind of a mishmash of names, and right, so that would just add to it if you add in a whole nother. Yeah, okay.
And I'm not sure it was significant. I think that maybe because we spent 210 years in Egypt, it might have had significance to us to understand some of the Egyptian psyche and culture and the name, like what they would refer to their king and how that worked.
Right.
Whereas these kings are a little bit more of a blip on the scenery, like meaning it's Avram saving Lot and it was a powerful king, but you didn't necessarily need a picture of who they were, who their culture was.
Right, it's true. He's not really interacting. I mean, he's fighting with them, but he's not interacting with them the way that he does with Paro. Which in turn, maybe that's kind of foretelling the interaction we'll have with, foreshadowing rather, of the interaction we'll have. Okay, that's interesting. Right, so at least in the very, plain sense, that's a very good point, but just in the plain sense, the pattern here doesn't fit with the pattern that we have with Paro. So why does it change? I looked around and nobody spoke about it. But the Sforno, and others, he just happens to be one of the earlier Mefarshim that touches on this, notes that back at the very end of Parshas Vayeshev, when Sarah Ofim, Sarah Mashkin are thrown into prison, if it's actually the Tsar or somebody else, there's some strange things going on in the Lashon of those Pesukim. And he says as follows. So Chatu Mashke Melech Mitzrayim Va'ofe. Avdei Sarah Mashkin Va'avdei Sarah Ofim. So, who actually sinned? Because I'll say that what happened was the bread had a pebble in it, and the cup of wine had a fly floating in the top. So, who actually sinned? Certainly by the baking, that process, the official, the Sar HaOfim, who was actually in front of Paro, had no idea that there was a pebble in the bread. He didn't knead the dough. He didn't bake the bread. That was his slave, or his the kind of lower level guy who's actually working in the kitchen. So that's why the pasuk says Chatu Mashke Melech Mitzrayim, the actual cup server, Kaper Va'ofe, in the baker. It doesn't say, it doesn't link Melech Mitzrayim to Ofe. Whereas with the Mashke, there, the guy at the top of the food chain, right under Paro, who's bringing him his actual coast, could see that there's a fly floating in the top of the coast, regardless of whether or not he's the one that actually poured the wine.
That makes sense in terms of what the passage was, but the Sforno, just looking at his words, he says, Avdei Sarah Ahmashim, the Avdei Sarah Ofam. So it's just, like, he seems to be
right, he was, so
on
he,
both of them.
Right.
Just
oh, so yeah, no. I'm thinking of somebody else. It's not the Sforno. Somebody else. Maybe it was the. It was the Netziv. It was one of the later Mefarshim. Does point out what I'm saying, but you're right. I think the Sforno's part is that everybody just gets thrown in jail. Because you're right. He says in the first part on Pasuk Aleph Avdei, the Avadim of both Sarah Mashkin and Sarah Ofim. So the whole food chain gets thrown in jail. Iktov Paro al Shnei Sarisav, and he gets angry at them. Shelo Hishgichu al Avdeihem. So he's also upset at them. They presumably end up in jail also. Right. So that was. You're right. The Sforno's not making that point that it, really you could have looked in the cup of wine yourself and seen it, which I mean is true. But regardless, everybody gets thrown in jail. But there, this is one of the places where it switches. It goes from Melech Mitzrayim to Paro in the course of, you know, from one pasuk to the next. And when it uses Paro, it says Al Shnei Sarisav there on his two kind of chamberlains, the higher up officials who are in charge of running the kitchen, of running the wine cellar. So there, I was wondering. Obviously, he's talking. This Sforno's focused on why is there a difference between the terminology in terms of the servants, but it also switches in terms of the language used for the king. And so, just as it's a change in terms of whether or not the person is actually interacting with Paro, the language changes regarding Paro as well. So, in the first part, with Melech Mitzrayim, there it's this Sforno says Avdei Sarah Mashkin. That it's just, you know, the guys that are staying in the kitchen or in the wine cellar, they have no interaction with Paro. They would never go in front of him. They're too lowly for that. That would be below Paro's kavod. But the Sarei Amashkin, the Sarei Ofim, they are in front of Paro. They're the ones actually serving the food to him, putting it on his table. There it says Paro. So Paro, therefore, perhaps would denote that demonstrate the fact that we're literally in Paro's presence when it uses that term. And Melech Mitzrayim is just kind of the vague general term. It's the king far off in his palace. Whereas Paro is, you're literally in front of him. And then that becomes very interesting when you look at Yosef being pulled out of prison. Paro has his dreams at the beginning of Miketz, and there it uses only Paro, because we're literally there with Paro experiencing the dreams. We're right there with him. He's the focus of the narrative. But also, when he's pulled out of prison, Yosef goes from the very bottom straight to the top. There's no Melech Mitzrayim. It's just... right, so Paro sends to him. They take him out of the boar, as it were. They get him dressed up, cleaned up, presentable. Yavo el Paro. And he goes to Paro. And Paro is speaking to him, etc., etc. But the point being, it's him and Paro. He's in the direct presence of the king. But it's not just of the, you know, king of Egypt. Historically, and the Meshech Chochmah points this out, I don't know if he was basing himself on historical knowledge. I mean, Chazal state this as well, that the king of Egypt, at least for kind of earlier, in earlier kingdoms of ancient Egypt, was viewed as God, basically. It was an Egyptian god. So it was divine. So in that case, and we apply that to this Paro as well, the Paro of Yosef. And so Yosef is pulled out from the bottom level. He's in prison, all the way to the top. Now, all of a sudden, he's talking to the Egyptian god, as it were. So just to go through, at least kind of quickly, through the Meshech Chochmah, because I think it could really... it's an interesting point in terms of how we would view Paro, but also Yosef's role in kind of enabling that process of Paro truly... becoming divine in his own eyes. Bata yirei Paro ish navon v'chacham v'yashasehu al eretz Mitzrayim. Or yashasehu, rather, I think. That his Yosef's advice to Paro is find somebody who's going to be a good advisor, who's wise, knowledgeable in these matters, and have him rule eretz Mitzrayim. Which is interesting advice that Paro has these dreams. Yosef says there's going to be a famine coming, so you should put somebody in control of Eretz Mitzrayim, as if to say, you, the king, are not really in control. So the first thing the Meshech Chochmah says is, Yitachin de'ikar ha'arasa chalam haya shvalim. The real focus of these dreams was the wheat, shemara ala rav. Medua hiktim chaloma haparos. The real focus, again, he tells him about the famine that's coming, so why... if that's the focus, which is demonstrated by the wheat, why are the cows first? Why is that the first dream? So he quotes a story from the Yerushalmi, which I'll just say out loud right now, or say outside rather, that Alexander of Macedon, is Alexander the Great, visits a certain king, Kazia, and so King Kazia greets him. He offers him a plate of gold. Which is quite a way to be greeted. And Alexander the Great says, I don't need gold. I'm here to see how you guys run your courts. How is justice served out in wherever in the world you are? I don't know if Kazia is the name of the king himself or of the... this is Medina's Kedem, but either way, they go to the court and they see there's two men in arguing. One man says, I sold my ashpa, my kind of trash heap dunghill, to man B. And they're arguing about what was sold, what was bought. The man who bought it says, I only bought a dunghill. It turns out he kind of dug up, the ashpa and found a pile of gold. And the man who bought it and dug it up is saying, I only bought the ashpa, it sounds backwards. I don't totally understand why it seems like this, but the man who bought it and discovered the gold says, I only bought the ashpa. I did not buy the gold. Maybe he's saying, I'm not going to pay you any extra for the fact that I found gold. And the man who sold it said, no, I sold you the ashpa and everything that's inside. And so they're going back and forth. And so King Kazia says, to one, do you have a son? And he says, yes. And to the other, he says, do you have a daughter? Yes. Okay, so have them get married, and then the ashpa, but more importantly, the gold will belong to both of you. It'll be, you know, shared amongst the family. Problem solved. And so Kinkazia sees Alexander the Great sitting there, kind of looking bewildered, and he said, what's wrong? How would you have dealt with this? Well, Alexander says, I would have just killed them both and kept the gold. Kinkazia, which, you know, if you're Alexander the Great, I guess you can do that. But Kinkazia says, oh, well, there's your problem. He says to Alexander, does it rain in your country? He says, yeah, it does. And does the sun actually shine? And he says, yeah. Well, the reason all that happens, the reason why you have this natural course of events, is not because you are an upright and just nation, but it's really because of the behemos. God is saving the animals, and he's allowing you to have rain in merit of the animals. I mean, you have less justice, less worth than the cattle. And that's what Paro's dream is supposed to be demonstrating to him, that you are being given Yosef, you are being given kind of a way out of upcoming trouble because of literally the animals, not because of the way that you are running your country. And he goes on, we're almost out of time, so he goes on and just describes how Paro was Kodosh La Mitzrim. He was holy to them. And now that would place him in a very kind of difficult situation. If you're supposed to be running the country and involved with very human affairs, it's very difficult to be separate and sanctified at the same time. So the way to fix that is to put somebody else in control of the country, somebody that you know you can trust. And that's what he accomplishes by Yosef. So Yosef's presence, obviously we have the whole idea of what it does for Yosef and enabling his family later on to get food and be taken care of. But it also enables Paro to kind of become more of a false god in his own eyes and the eyes of his country, which is an interesting other side of the coin there. The Meshech Chochma also describes how at that point, before Yosef came along, the whole system of justice in Mitzrayim was completely skewed, and everyone, any minor official, could just go and do whatever they wanted. Point case, Potiphar. For some private dispute, Yosef didn't do anything, and he wasn't rebelling against Paro or anything. He was being accused of having slept with Potiphar's wife, which, I mean, it's not correct, but it's also a private affair. It's not, it's not a public scandal, per se, or rebellion against the government. So he gets thrown straight into jail, and there's no, he doesn't go through court or anything like that. And the Meshech Chochma points out that that's not necessarily a healthy system of justice, that anybody can just throw anybody else into jail. And that in turn later on is why Yosef, when he wants to throw his brothers in jail for really no reason, legally at least, I mean there's a reason in his eyes, but in terms of Egyptian justice there's no reason, he has to say Meraglimatem, you are spies, and then it goes straight to Paro. I mean, you're rebelling against Paro himself, the divinity of Egypt, and therefore I have the right just to throw you in jail without any recourse, without any sort of trial or checks and balances. And so Yosef's role seemingly establishes some level of checks and balances there. And he has another piece. A little bit later on where he kind of expands upon this, the Meshech Chochma does. And he, at one point, so this is in that other piece where he's describing how Paro says to his other officials there regarding Yosef that he has Ruach Elohim, which I thought was interesting because when you look in Chazal described that Paro just was looking around in his books of religion and seemingly didn't have any record of the God of the Jews. Didn't have any record of Hashem. And so he says, you know, who is this Hashem that you're speaking of? what he says later on. And I thought it was interesting, well, if that's how we're viewing it, at least through the understanding of Chazal, what does Ruach Elohim mean? So in Dat Mikra, they describe that it's the same usage as Ruach Hashem by Bezalel, that it just means kind of a level of wisdom and nevuah. And that's what Paro is describing about Yosef. And that Elohim, just it was basically the Torah translating whatever word Paro actually used into our terminology, into the Torah's terminology. He didn't actually say Elohim. Presumably, wasn't speaking Hebrew, as far as we know. I wouldn't assume he was speaking Hebrew. In which case, it's very similar to what we were speaking earlier, that Paro is kind of this unique word that we use by Mitzrayim because we have such a long relationship with the culture of Mitzrayim that we use their word for the king to kind of place us in that actual context. So again, that really, when you see the word Paro, that I haven't tested this against everything that happens in Shmos, but seemingly that places us in his actual presence and everything that follows with that, everything that connotates. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see also with all the different psukim that are quoted in the Haggadah and everything that's stated in Magid, which terms are used. So we're supposed to view ourselves as actually having been there. So is it Melech Mitzrayim or Paro? I think it's mostly Paro, but I didn't check that. All right. Good Shabbos, happy Hanukkah, have a great rest of the week.